Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast, voted Best Podcast 2016 by Phoenix New Times. I'm Brian Dunn, and this episode is Susan DeFreitas reading her short story, Pyrophytic, live at Spillers No. 7 on March 14th, 2017. Enjoy.
We have a writer who's going to come up here. So we actually discovered her through
litreactor.com, a very cool online writing community. She is one of the columnists there. And we reached out to her, and it turns out that, well, we tried to get her for Spillers number six.
Six.
But we couldn't do that because of scheduling conflicts. She actually lives in Portland, Oregon, but she has Northern Arizona ties. She went to Prescott College up north.
Where Brian grew up.
Where I grew up, yes. So we put her in the event book because she submitted such a great short story for six, but we couldn't actually have her on the stage. And then we actually interviewed her when she swung through Phoenix. And now we have her here tonight, because as of right now, she has the distinction of being the only person who has been in the book and on the podcast, but has not been on the stage.
She is a Spillers anomaly. She's
really
like
is.
Pie.
No free pie.
So, with that said.
With that said.
She has a new novel out, and it's out there with Jeff with the merch booth. It's called Hot Season.
Yep.
Miss Susan DeFreitas, everyone.
I am going to read from my debut novel, Hot Season, which was published November 1st by Harvard Square Editions. I like to call it a tale of youth, lust, and radical activism in the Southwest. The name of this chapter is Pyrophytic, which means fire-loving. Winters in Cresttop were generally mild, despite the altitude. That was one of the things Rel loved about her college town. The way snow was no more than a novelty, a snow globe fantasy of soft, swirling flakes that melted away the next day like a dream. But the winter of her senior year snapped hard and cold with temps in the teens and brought so much snow that it shut the town down. She was almost happy to go home to Pittsburgh for the holidays, where at least the roads were plowed. But her boyfriend, Trevor, was increasingly vague on the phone, and by the time New Year's rolled around, Rel had begun to suspect that he had not driven to Mendocino to see his sister the way he had claimed, that he'd stayed in Cresttop instead. Why? And why had he lied? It was clear from the moment she walked in the door. Someone had left a peachy pink windbreaker on the coat rack by the wood stove. Someone had left a bar of honeysuckle soap on the ceramic dish by the sink. Someone had been sleeping in her bed and cuddling with her cat and using her loofah to buff her butt for all Rel knew. That someone was Trina, a perky adventure education major with chiseled biceps. Trevor had been meaning to tell Rel about her, but he'd felt like Rel would be mad. Well, no shit, she wanted to tell him, and a few choice things as well, but it was all so immature and awkward and awful that her voice never made it past the hard lump that had formed in her throat. At that point, nothing she could have said would have made a difference anyway. The happy couple was long past the love goggles stage and on to the type of passive-aggressive bickering that had taken Rel and Trevor years to achieve. What she wanted more than anything then was her own space. A clear, sunny space with sweeping views of the Bradshaw Mountains where she could sit and sip her tea in the mornings. Counter space and sink space, free of Trevor's dishes. Wall space and head space, free of his reggae posters and glassware, the skunky funk of his pot. A quiet space of her own where she could lay out the maps and cuttings associated with her senior thesis, which centered on those perverse plants of the Southwest that require fire to germinate. But the breakup had arrived at the beginning of January, which was the wrong time of year for space in Cresttop. Moreover, Space cost the kind of money Trevor had, but Rel did not. So she was forced to take up residence in her final semester of college in a room the size of a shoebox in a janky old rat trap in the barrio, which, for the record, was surrounded by all manner of noise. Domestic altercations, house parties, smack-talking little eight-year-old hoods, and wholly lacking in views unless you counted the two built-down mobile homes across the alley out back. There was a yard, at least, with space for a garden, which was something she'd wanted that Trevor had not. But the house itself was full of tacky linoleum and questionable carpet, and had been rented by students for so long that no one had any idea who half the crappy furniture in it belonged to. Fortunately for Rel, it was also so drafty that the two freshmen who'd signed the lease on the place were looking for a roommate in the off-season just to help them cover the heat. 737 Sycamore Street was a world away from the pimped-out cabins in the foothills of the Bradshaws, favored by trust fund babies and rock jocks like Rel's ex. But Trevor and Trina were like smoke that spring. No matter where Rel went or what she did, she could not seem to avoid them. Spring being the season when the Forest Service set the woods on fire. A controlled burn, they call it. A minor disaster now, while there was still snowmelt in the mountains, meant to stave off a major disaster later. Trevor and Trina at the coffee shop, Trevor and Trina at the bar, Trevor and Trina on the campus commons, cinched in a skeezy lip lock, flexing their firmly muscled forearms in an effort to bring themselves impossibly closer. Whenever Rel least expected it, the smell of smoke would find her, and she'd find herself blinking back tears. Rel had studied the life cycles of pyrophytic plants, even transected a quarter-mile section of the Bridal Creek fire, which had nearly burned to the Crestop city limits. She understood that what was happening out there was normal, necessary even. And yet it pained her that spring, the way so many things that had taken so long to grow were dying. And now here she sat on the back porch with her roommate, Katie, who was all of 18, inhaling what was possibly the strongest rolling tobacco on the face of the earth. The organic American spirit was even worse than the regular, and smoking it felt like being kicked by a horse. But this, they reasoned, was what kept them from smoking more than they did, so they kept on buying it. Apparently, Katie was saying, "Dude is a bit of a skank." Super skank or just your average? Probably just your average, but Jenna thinks he's like Mr. Romance. It was the first real warm day of the year, and the old apple tree in the backyard was sizzling with drunken honeybees. It was too nice out to get any work done. Too nice out to do anything, it seemed, except lie around in the sun gossiping about their roommate's love life. "It's a shame," Katie said. "Scott's such a nice guy." Scott really was a nice guy. So nice he'd followed Jenna all the way across the country when she left for college. So nice he was training to be an emergency medical technician so he could help people professionally, he said, as in for a living. When it came down to it, Scott wasn't even bad looking. It was just that he didn't drink or smoke or even swear. And he didn't really seem to get into much of anything besides running, which he did religiously at 6 a.m. So now Jenna and this new guy, who she'd been spending a lot of time with at the school bike shop, had started going out to the bars together too. Rel took a drag off their cigarette, her eyes watering. "They say sometimes it's just like a sneeze, right? Like if you hold out long enough, it'll go away. Aren't you supposed to pinch your nose to stop a sneeze?" Katie asked. "Or push your tongue against the roof of your mouth?" Rel passed her the cigarette from the couch, loosening a chunk of stuffing from a hole in the upholstery. Katie took the cigarette and pulled a long drag. What if Scott's really like Jenna's soulmate, she wondered. What if she winds up blowing the love of her life for this Crockett dude who winds up being a total skankfest? Then she should take up running. But what if Crockett is really her soulmate? What if Jenna denies her connection with him and then spends the rest of her life wondering what they could have had? Rel found herself amazed sometimes by Katie's sheer credulity. The girl fell for someone new every day of the week, it seemed, and she acted as if every crush was her last. To her, this wasn't a matter of doing your long-time boyfriend the simple courtesy of breaking up with him before screwing someone else. Or, hey, even not screwing someone else. It was an infinitely tangled conundrum with no real solution. But maybe this was why Rel had spent more time with Katie than any of her actual girlfriends that spring. Those ladies who, like Rel, had loved and lost and accrued an air of world-weary sophistication on the subject. Katie was a freshman, a romantic, a true believer in the sweet notion that any little spark of attraction could keep you warm for the rest of your life. "Shh," Katie whispered. "He's right here." "Who? Dude?" A skinny, shirtless fellow in a floppy hat was making his way through their backyard, past the coils of chicken wire and their new garden beds. He had long brown hair and a goatee and was trailing what appeared to be an Alsatian. It followed along behind him on a length of rope as he made his way to their back porch steps. "Ladies," he said, "beautiful day." Rel shot Katie a look. "Is that a goat?" They were now eye level with the thing, and it was indeed a goat. With its cloven hooves, bulging belly, and slanted pupils, there was nothing else for it to be. "This is Molly," he said. "Molly, meet Katie," said Katie. "And Rel." Molly, unimpressed, chewed her cud. "And who might you be?" Rel knew very well who he was, but neither she nor Katie had officially been introduced. "Crockett, at your service." Crockett removed his floppy hat and held it to his chest, like an old-time country suitor. An effect made ironic by his tattoo, which depicted a lion wearing a crown. It stared fiercely at them over the brim of his hat, waving its tricolor flag. "Molly and I were actually wondering if Miss Jenna was around." Again, Rel cast a glance at Katie. "Jenna's over at Scott's, isn't she?" "Oh, yeah." Katie twirled a strand of her highlights, its various shades of blonde, in a supremely casual manner. "Haven't seen her around. We can tell her you stopped by, though." "Cool." Crockett fit his hat back on his head as if to leave, but then he just stood there at the foot of their steps, grinning, like some kind of neighborhood stray, hoping for a warm bed, maybe, or a dish with his name on it. "If you don't mind me saying," he said, "I had no idea Jenna lived with two such attractive women." Out of the corner of her eye, Rel caught Katie smirking down at a couple of elm beetles making their way across the porch, their hind ends stuck together. In just the past few days, the entire town had become infested with millions of these little black and red bugs, all doing their best to get laid. "If you don't mind my saying," Rel said, "it looks like your goat is taking a crap." There was, in fact, no denying it. Even as Rel spoke, little brown pellets were dropping to the ground to the aft of the goat. Crockett shook his head. "Molly." His grin had turned sheepish, but he seemed less embarrassed than amused. He walked over to the side of the backyard shed, returned with their shovel, and then scooped that pile of goat pellets aloft and carried it over to the garden beds they'd prepared. He proceeded to work the manure in systematically, thoroughly, breaking up the hard clods of dirt they'd missed. Probably with more effort than strictly necessary. The boy was so skinny that his belt barely held his pants up, and the top of his boxers showed below his slim hips. But he was lithe and brown, and his muscles rippled as he worked, and there was no denying that he looked good, or that it felt good, sitting outside on a warm day in the spring to watch a man break a sweat in the sun. "Ladies," he said, "is there anything else I can do for you?" "No, or else," Katie said, I think that'll do it. Crockett smiled and tipped his hat. Then he turned, took his goat's lead, and made his way back down the alley. Rel turned to Katie. She'd been about to make fun of the boy's hairless chest, the Lion of Judah tattooed there. Instead, she let loose with a sneeze. Thank you.
That was Susan DeFreitas reading her short story, Pyrophytic, at Spillers No. 7 at Valley Bar on March 14th, 2017. For all Spillers After Show podcast episodes, go to spillersaftershow.com. For more information on Spillers, the voice of Phoenix fiction, go to spillers.net.